Resources Committee is now convened at the appropriate hour. Representative Roses has been excused. Present are Representatives Guttenberg, Edgman, Coring, Seaton, Kawasaki, Wilson, Johnson, and Gatto. Meeting is come to order. We have a sponsor of the bill here, and we're continuing from the previous meeting and dealing with pipeline corrosion. And thank you. The sponsor of the bill has an amendment that he's proposed. Did you want to sit up front there?
I'll let Conrad do it.
Let Conrad do it? That's the right answer.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to move the amendment for discussion?
I would appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd offer as amendment number one, 25LS0561 / K-1 Bullock for discussion.
I'll object.
So we have a couple of objections, and that's usually because we do want to have a discussion on what we're listening to. Sometimes on the floor, there is only a quarter of a second between an amendment and without objection, but I try to allow more than one second. So please proceed. For the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Now, before you today is the amendment on page 3, line 22 and 23 of the bill that deletes the word standard practices of the industry and inserts good oil field practice. And the amendment was derived from conversations with our office, with Don Bullock from Ledge Legal, and with the other involved departments. We do have Don Bullock here that can answer any more technical, legal-type questions that the committee might have.
And isn't it wonderful to be brief? Okay. Questions from the committee?
Are we going to bring up Mr. Bullock? Or
want to hear Mr. Bullock first? That works for me.
Whatever you.
Thank you. Mr. Bullock, pleasure to have you again. Who's doing your work while you're here?
Well, some of you may have asked me for things that may be a little delayed now and then.
And the move to adjourn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Bullock. I'm an attorney with Legislative Legal Services. And the amendment before you is a suggestion that was made by John Iverson, who's the director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue, and Rob Mintz, who's a contract attorney and formerly with the Department of Law in their oil and gas section. And they looked at different sources of information that they could use to establish the standard of expectation for maintenance. And they found several references to good oil field practice, and they feel that using this term in place of standard practices of the industry would give them a better base to operate from. And, you know, in a way, it may seem like it's not that simple to find this, because the PPT changes the way of taxation compared to the norm. Normally, taxes and royalty issues don't get to the cost of production, so the change in the PPT is what generated this. And so it's a new area of law, and this goes back to expectations and what the standard, what's expected in return for the deduction, and how can the Department of Revenue determine whether a deduction is appropriate with the policies that you folks set.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And is the term good oil field practice then defined in statute, or is that somewhere in?
It's mentioned in the Manual of Oil and Gas Terms, and there are cases that refer to that standard there. There are sources that use that.
Okay, so our reference here is to a legal term that has a definite definition, or is this definition?
Well, there's legal terms and there's legal terms. You could say that the only legal term would be a definition that's found in statute somewhere, but there's also legal terms that courts have defined for as necessary to apply the law, and this, I believe, is more of a common law term. It could have been developed in a contract. I mean, the things that you're looking at here are normally the type of things that would come up between working interest owners and unit operators and not governments. And so the sources generally are limited unless there's been litigation on an issue like this.
And
go ahead.
To follow up then, I guess I'm trying to find, I mean, good oil field practice sounds like a term that could occur in many places or in several places and mean several different things. So is there a specific citation that we need to have to this, or is this a term that has more than one meaning depending upon which part?
I believe it's mentioned to the Manual of Oil and Gas Terms, and that's a generally recognized resource. When I was researching this bill at the request of the sponsor, I spent quite a bit of time trying to find a universal standard, and there just isn't. And that's why it's important that the committee consider what kind of standard you want to apply. And this is the approach that the Department of Revenue feels that they can find the most information about, that they can say, this is what we expect. And if you did what we expected, you get the deductions. If it was something less than what would be expected under this standard, then the deduction would be denied or adjusted.
One additional follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my question revolves around the three words before this, and that's taking into consideration. So they're going to make a determination, taking into consideration. Now, does that mean that they are required to follow the standards of good oil field practice that you just mentioned they would find as a standard? Does that mean
it means that they have to look at the standard when they're making their decision as to what's expected. They would take that into consideration and give it appropriate weight. They may find other standards that are also applicable. They may look at perhaps a standard operating agreement form to see what normally would be expected. I mean, it's trying to establish, again, expectations. What kind of care is expected? What kind of avoidance of unnecessary costs could be anticipated? Like I say, this is a new area, and they felt that they needed some discretion and some area within which they can operate to be reasonable, because no doubt this type of expense will be appealed if the deduction is disallowed. And obviously, they want to make a good case ahead of time.
We've had some conversations on this exact term, good oil field practice, to do with maintenance, proper maintenance, and improper maintenance. And I thought about that for a long time, and I said, let's imagine that we have two Ford Tauruses out of the factory, one after another, same car, identical. And one is used to commute from Palmer to Anchorage, drop off an envelope, and commute right back again, 80 miles. The other one is a taxi that runs around Anchorage and more traffic lights than you can imagine, 80 miles. Now, good maintenance on one car is so different from good maintenance on the other car. And when we get to a pipeline, good maintenance in Saudi Arabia, good maintenance in pick a place where we're doing this is certainly different than good maintenance in the North Sea and good maintenance in the Arctic. And so the word good has to apply this field, in this place, at this time, in this weather, under these conditions, with these volumes and this acidity and pick more. Do we get there, or is this just wide open for everyone and his uncle to say, you know, I'll tell you what I think good means. And no two people will probably have the same thing to say, except, well, I'm going to say good is whatever they do in Texas. Well, you get away with murder if that's what you're doing up here.
Well, I have a couple comments. I mean, like in the owner's manual on my car, it talks about intensive driving, that you may have to change the oil more often. And we've dealt with the uniqueness of oil because it is unique. It's going to have different proportions of carbon compounds in it. Some of it's going to have more sulfur, some will be less. And when it came time to value the oil for determining what the wellhead value was compared to other oils, we had to make adjustments. We had to look at how much our oil might produce through a refinery that was available. And you'll see that in posted prices. If refineries are limited in the type of oil they can produce, they will post a better price for oil that they would like to have run through their plant compared to something that would be hard to do. So it's not just a location issue. It is, like you referred to, that it does have to do with what's in the oil itself. Some oil is going to be more corrosive. But it's, I think the standards would look at, well, what do you do? How closely do you look at the oil? How do you identify the problems that you could expect in a particular field? And then you can go out and look at the industry and see, how did they handle high sulfur oil in this particular field? Or how did they handle oil from another field that had particularly a low API gravity that might be more difficult to move through because it's thicker? So these are all factors that are taken into consideration. And that's why the department needs the discretion, because there isn't a silver bullet standard that you can say, you know, you got to do like just like this.
Sure. And our oil, we put biocides in before it's put in the pipe to kill critters. And with low oil flow, we had some precipitates in the low pieces. The critters got under the precipitates, set up shop, and ate metal pipe. Under high flow, washed right down and killed by the biocide. So now we've got the same environment. Depending on the flow, good oil field practices are different from non-good.
Right, the flow is going to make a difference. But on the facts, you know, you're going to have to trust the oil companies. I mean, that's one of the limitations on the government side. There are risks that we can identify and that are within the scope of regulation of the government, but actual industry, how things work. And actually, the industry is going to be the best source for what constitutes good oil field practice.
Okay, and we have several people from the industry who would like to testify. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bullock, did I hear you correctly? You said from an oil field manual. Did I hear that right, or was?
There's a manual of oil and gas terms that's one of the best sources, and that manual is based on court cases that have defined particular terms. I can't remember the author's name offhand.
Mr. Chairman, do we have a copy of that any place around?
It's in the legislative law library. And,
oh, yeah.
And I have a copy on my desk. I always
spent a lot of time there.
we spent a lot of time in the library. That's right. And I was a good college student.
it's an expensive book. I forget how much it is, $60 or $80, so it's not the type of information you can find for free on the internet.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, I'm wondering, what would be the matter with us taking that definition and putting it in the bill?
I think you could. And this came back to what we talked about the other day, about maybe coming up with some presumptions that the legislature finds would constitute good practice. It was brought up in another committee as perhaps how often the line is pegged or inspected would be a factor. But again, it comes back to what would you expect? How often is reasonable? So that whatever standard you pick not only reflects your policy, but actually reflects what you're speaking to.
And there's different pegs and different ways to inspect.
Yeah.
Just doesn't stop.
Again, the folks in back of me would be a bit better at telling you the facts about that.
Well, you know, I would think that different temperatures would make a difference, and different flows would make a difference. But what I actually meant was not so much saying how often something had to be done, but taking the definition from the manual of oil and gas terms and putting that definition in here instead of kind of hoping that somebody will go find it.
I could do that. I mean, I'll take a look and see what I could come up with that.
And just buy several of these books and distribute them. Any more questions from the committee? Representative Johnson?
And you may not be the person to ask this, it may come later, but I have a question about within Prudhoe Bay and let's say if we ever get Anwar open and across the whole range of oils, is there inconsistency in the makeup of the oils on the slope? I mean, are we dealing with the same similar viscosity and sulfur content? I mean, is there a wide range of different types of oil through all of those fields? Are we looking at one oil that we can just say this is the standard because this is what it is and everything goes in should be the same way? Are we dealing with different times, different oils, different?
The companies would be in a better position to answer that, but I expect there would be some differences. For example, the oil that's produced from Cook Inlet is, last time I was aware, was of a higher API gravity, which means it's lighter than the oil that's produced on the North Slope. So even within the state, that there will be differences in how the oils make it.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, I guess the reason for the question is, are we going to have different standards for every barrel or different oil that comes through from a different field? If we start defining standards, are we going to say field A is going to be this standard, field B is going to be this standard? And so I'm wondering, if we go down that road, how big is this bill going to be in terms of just pure pages?
Yeah, through the chair, it's not so much how big the bill is going to be, but how much the Department of Revenue has to do to decide how broad the standard can be applied. But the factors for applying the standard may be the same. For example, the weight of the oil, the sulfur content, the acid, the other elements that are in the oil, so they can picture, once they've identified the type of oil that's going through a facility, they can come up with a standard that says that this is the dangerous part of this, this is the part you need to address, this is the corrosion, you know, this is how often you should inspect it. If there's high level of corrosive in the oil, you can inspect it less often. If it's more benign, I mean, some of this is speculation, and you need to ask those kind of questions to the industry.
Thank you. And I guess that kind of gets to the heart of my point. If every different oil we have to say, well, for this oil, this is a good standard, so it has to be picked this often. I mean, how do we monitor the flow into a pipeline when it's coming from all these different areas? Do we go with the worst case scenario and say the most corrosive, hardest oil to handle on the pipe is X, so we do everything for X, and if we're doing that, are we paying too much for the maintenance because we don't need to be dealing with X all the time? So are we gonna be in a situation where we're getting tax credits for doing stuff we don't need to do because we've set a standard that's for the worst case scenario?
I suggested it in the form of a presumption. Presumptions can be rebutted. So if the presumption was overly strict for one field, they could come in and say that the presumption is invalid with regard to this field because this is sweet oil. We don't expect it to be as corrosive. It doesn't have to do it.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, what I'd like to see is that presumption not being defined in court, because all of a sudden this oil was, you know, this presumption, and so what we'd like to craft is a piece of legislation that is not necessarily incident driven, but is good policy 10 and 15 years from now. And so that's the struggle that I have with this is, you know, how do you put something on the books that 10 years when another committee sitting here says those guys did a good job, or man, were they way off base? And I'd rather be on the good job side of that and scrutinize it. So that's kind of what I'm wrestling with, and it's maybe a question that the representatives are going to have to answer from the producers. But that's my struggle, is how do you establish a standard that they live up to and we don't have to settle all this stuff in court?
Right. Mr. Chair, if I could just make one comment on that. Although there may have been a particular incident that brought the issue that's raised in this bill to mind, this bill is not written to only apply in 2007, and good oil field practice would be looked at each time a tax return would be audited for the deductions. So as technology improves, the good oil field practice would also rise to a higher level as more is known and more preventive maintenance schemes can be identified and put in place.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. You know, this is one where I've got a lot of hands-on experience, and I can imagine doing a lot of things where it was the difference between doing the standard with these flow lines and doing something that would have been better. You know, and the answer would have been, you know, we would have kicked it uphill saying, why don't we do it this way? And they come back saying, no, that's how we do it. We won't walk through the manual and, no, we don't do it that way. We do it this way. But, Mr. Chair, I'm under the impression that this amendment addresses Representative Johnson's concern, because standard on one field or one situation or one type of oil wouldn't be the right standard on another. So if you simply, if you go to this definition of good, good oil field practices, then somebody could come in and say, well, that exactly that. That used to be the standard, but this is a good practice. And they could, and while there would be might be challenged by the department, they could say, no, this is the oil, this is the content we had, this is the viscosity, this is the flow rate. That might have been a standard in another situation, but this is the good standard here. And they could justify that and come back with the argument. But on the other side, you know, it goes both ways for both parties. They can come in and say, this standard is not necessarily the best in every situation. Just like you're talking about the Tauruses, the two different cars. What's the best thing to do in a certain situation? Instead of being so rigid, simply say standard.
You could always have the highest standard, apply to everything below it, and say, well, we can maybe hire one person for this job out of the universe, as the standard is so high, and we can't get that person, so now what?
Well, sometimes the highest standard causes things to break prematurely.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, maybe I'm just confused, but I think that we're talking a lot of times about the pipeline integrity stuff that we're doing. We've got pipeline integrity, the whole section. We've got a, you know, we're going to have regulations, and those are going to be dealing with those specific pipelines, if we're talking pipelines. And it seems like here we're trying to mix it into the tax bill, and I get very, very nervous when I hear, and I tried to write it down as close as I could, that good old oil field practices will be applied to each tax return. And not that there's an incident necessarily, but that when the tax return comes in and the deductions are there, and as I expressed the other day, my fear is that it's going to depend upon the financial condition of the state as to how much scrutiny is going to be applied to those tax returns and the deductions. And, you know, I guess I'm just worried about it because I've commented on federal regulations before, and they take into consideration, that means they looked at the piece of paper and then they did their own thing, but they did look at the paper, so they took them into consideration. So I'm not sure that writing taking into consideration good oil field practices really gets us to saying you will measure this by good oil field practices. All it says is, oh, yeah, you opened the page and there were good oil field practices. But I mean, it's obvious that any time that there's a problem, it wouldn't have been the good oil field practice for that pipeline with that oil, with that flow, with that temperature, because there was a problem that was unexpected. And if it was something that could have been anticipated, it's already covered under gross negligence. And so my problem with this is that we've got this standard that is not even as high as gross negligence. I think it's somewhere between simple negligence and strict liability. So I don't even know why we have gross negligence in the bill if we adopt this, because gross negligence is always going to be improperly maintained. It's going to be at least this standard, if it ever rises to gross negligence. So there's really no reason to even have gross negligence in the bill. And so would you?
Thank you.
I know that wasn't that, I know that wasn't a good question, but I think you can see my dilemma, and I'm trying to figure out the standard.
Sure. Through the chair, I'll take a shot at it. Now, I don't mean to say that every time that there's a tax return filed that they're going to come up with a different determination of what good oil field practice is. It's going to be field specific, and it may apply over a couple of years. I mean, what happens on an audit is it's the same thing we're all exposed to when we file our individual tax returns. If we have unusual deductions that catch an auditor's eye, then they're going to come and look at the basis for the deduction. In this case, if there's an extraordinary, seems like in 1 year there's suddenly a cost that's quite a bit higher that's taken as a deduction, that may trigger an audit. And what this comes back to is the state is giving up a dollar of deduction for a dollar of cost in maintaining the field. And that works out to about 22.5 cents for every dollar that's spent. And if it's a qualified capital expenditure, that's another 20% out of that dollar. So the real question is, what does the state expect? Does it expect poor oil field practice to be the standard? So are we willing to share the cost of poor maintenance or improper maintenance? Or are we going to say that this is our money, we don't want you to spend money unnecessarily, so we're going to ask that you comply with good oil field practice, with how the industry defines it, its practice itself. What is good oil practice from the industry standpoint? And if it is, and there's still a problem, you know, that we've said the standard is good oil field practice, even if it doesn't get us as much protection as we want from our revenue stream. So what this is it's trying to use the industry's own standard to be reasonable and apply the state's expectations to these expenses to say these are the ones we're going to share the cost in, and something less we choose not to share the cost.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know who to ask this question, but does anybody know, since this happened up on the North Slope, has the department itself changed any of their regulations? And I mean, are they looking at things a little differently than they did before? And if they are, maybe this is covered just in regulation, and I'd kind of like to know if anybody could answer that.
I should ask John Iverson that. I think he's probably one of the lead people on the regulations. The regulations I know are still in process. There was an original set that they were working on, and then they expect to be adopting more. We also remember that the first returns are only going to be filed at the end of this month. They have to be filed before April 1st, and that'll be the first time the state really sees how the PPT is working and what kind of expenses are being deducted.
Thank you. Additional questions?
Can we?
John Iverson, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is John.
John, did you hear the question?
I did.
Would you please address that if you can?
Certainly, through the chair. We haven't, this first round of regulations that's come out, we're envisioning two rounds of regulations. The first round of regulations that has come out that's still subject to final approval, although it has been approved by the commissioner. It still needs to go through the final review from law, which I think is close to being done. And then any substantive changes that are made will need to be reapproved by the commissioner and then eventually through the lieutenant governor's office. That's the first round of regs. That round of regs has not addressed the issue of lease expenditures in the context that we're talking about in this section. So that would be the part of the second regulations project, which we're beginning to look at and are going to be working on through the spring and summer. The other part of the question was in regard to whether the legislature needs to actually put this into a statute as opposed to what's in the law already. When we draft regulations, we're limited as to what we can say in our regs by what's in the statute. We just, the regulations implement the statute. Any regulations that would be with outside of the bounds of what's in the statute would be subject to legal challenge. If we were to write a regulation that expressly incorporates the language that's in this bill as to improper maintenance, that would be subject to a legal challenge. That doesn't mean it would necessarily get shot down, but it would be more subject to legal challenge than if the legislation, than if we were actually going off this express language in the statute. Stated another way, a regulation that we would draft like this does not find explicit basis in the statute. That doesn't mean we can't necessarily get there. It's just that if the legislature wants to make sure and clarify that these sorts of costs are going to be excluded, then the bulletproof way to do it would be through a statute.
Thank you.
Any other questions for John while he's attentive? Any other questions for Mr. Bullock?
Okay.
Judy Brady, are you online? Judy?
Yes, I'm on.
You would like to testify on this bill?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please go ahead and identify yourself.
All right. For the record, my name is Judy Brady. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I think you have in your packet a copy of our testimony. What I'm going to do is just spend a few minutes.
Judy, could I stop you for a second?
Sure.
I think I may have things out of order, and you're wanting to testify on the bill, and I think what we have before us is the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's my fault, and I apologize. I got the cart before the horse, and Representative Gatto is back, and I will turn it back to him.
All right, thank you.
Now that I've totally messed it up for you. I had to testify, and we're still on the amendment. So.
Okay.
So I apologize.
Is this Judy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Did you have some comments on the amendment? Or?
No, Mr. Chairman, I didn't. This is about the way my week's been going.
All right. We do have you scheduled here to be first because I understand you have some deadlines. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Okay. But I did not intend to comment on the amendment right now because we're committee driven. Our committee has not had a chance to take a look at the language yet.
Okay. Well, we have an amendment in front of us here, and I suppose we ought to dispose of the amendment and then have Mrs. Brady talk. So
I'll remove my objection to the amendment.
Okay. So is there any other objection to the amendment? Seeing and hearing none, then the amendment passes. So, Mrs. Brady.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
It is your time in the barrel.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Judy Brady. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I believe you have our testimony there for your packet. What I'm going to do is go through a short summary of our concerns, and then you can ask questions if you like. First of all, I apologize for not being there. I have an ear infection, and I can't fly right now. We are opposing this legislation because we believe that, in fact, the state is already protected, and we also believe that legally, constitutionally, this bill will not survive a legal challenge.
Judy, now that the bill has been amended, is your testimony going to be the same, amended or unamended, or will you be? Does it change with respect to the amendment that's already passed?
Mr. Chairman, since the amendment was just introduced and adopted today, our members have not had a chance to take a look at it. It certainly is moving in the right direction. I will tell you that. My testimony today is not going to be directly to the language. It was going to be, but right now it's going to be a little bit different.
Okay, and I will tell you in advance, I will be holding the bill till Monday, where we'll take it up again. So your testimony, we'll have an opportunity for you to make additional testimony on Monday with respect to how your testimony will be with the bill as amended.
Thank you very much. There was two things about this bill that are, of course, obvious to everybody. It had more sponsors than I think any piece of legislation in a long time, and it had most concerns about the language, so I'm glad to see the response to the language concerns. This afternoon, I'm going to spit in the wind and try to talk you into not passing the bill in the long run. And what I'm going to try to talk to you about for a few minutes is the fact that all of the things you've been talking about today, and in fact the last two hearings, are things the legislators talked about last year, and with the same problems, the same issues. And I'm going to try to convince you that the bill that you have, that exists already, is a belt and suspenders bill and gives you the protection that you're all concerned that you don't have. And there is this session, two precedents for people expressing a very strong concern, letting people know of that concern, and then after reviewing the information and understanding more, changing their mind about the necessity for the legislation or the point of view. And one, of course, is House Bill 30 with Representative Samuels and Senator Kerrio, who, after they learned more about the possible outcome, decided they did not need to go forward. And then, of course, just recently, Governor Palin, who, after she got more information, took a different viewpoint. So there's lots of precedent for people saying, yes, we expressed our concern, and now we believe that concern is satisfied. We're concerned about adding a whole broad category of costs that can't be deducted, that are ill-defined. You've already talked about that. That will throw us, the state and the oil and gas, into a constant adversarial relationship with litigation. Will raise the level of uncertainty about how to operate in the state. Where you're going with this bill is moving from an incident-related concern about cost to a place where you're going to end up requiring an audit of every single capital expense. There's no way you're going to get around that. I know John Iverson said the other day, oh, no, this is just going to be incident-related. It is incident-related now with some other bells and whistles. The way you're moving to change it, it is going to be every audit. It will have to be. I want to talk a little bit about the background. And again, the concern of the sponsors now is exactly the concern of the legislators last year, and for very good reason. The PPT did two things, as we all know. I'm just going to go through this real fast so we can talk about it in context. It was a new kind of tax legislation. It's unique in the world. It did two things. Number one, it raised taxes when prices are higher. And two, because there's this tremendous need for new investment in the state, they decided that the state would share some of the risk of the expense. And they would allow the deduction of lease expenditures that are immediately expensed before you come to the production tax value, and then in addition you get capital costs are eligible for 20%. And the purpose was to encourage reinvestment in Alaska. It did raise taxes, but it also raised very high concerns. There were hearing after hearing after hearing talking just about exactly what you're talking about. Well, shoot, how are we going to know how are we going to know what's a real expense and what's not an expense? We could be expensed right down to the point where we don't have any money, any tax money coming in. We could be expensed down to zero. How are we going to be able to audit this? All of the things you're raising now were raised over and over and over again at that time. And they came up with more and more and more answers. The first thing they did was, and if you look at, when you get a chance to look at again, the lease expenditures part of the bill, they start out with saying that for purposes of this bill, they're the ordinary lease expenditures are the ordinary and necessary costs upstream of the point of production that are direct costs of exploring for, developing, or producing oil or gas deposits. So that was the first thing. That was the first thing. That was the first requirement, direct and ordinary. Then further back in that section, they say, and if the cost is disputed by a working owner interest, the state doesn't have to pay that cost either. They were talking about the fact that the working owner interests have very highly developed audit capabilities. They audit each other all the time to see about costs. And if you don't think that's true, there's about 4,000 categories of costs for Prudhoe Bay alone that are constantly audited by the three or the four or five working partners.
Judy, is that an accurate number, 4,000 categories, or just kind of?
I think it's pretty accurate.
Thank you.
I mean, we're not talking a checklist here. We're talking a huge operation that's with hundreds of miles of pipe and huge facilities with hundreds of miles of pipe in them as well, and interest owners whose value depends on keeping those costs reasonable. So at the end, there's almost 8 pages here of discussion under lease expenditures trying to close gaps about how you decide what can be deducted and what you can't be deducted. Now remember that just before the House passed the PPP bill, the incident on August 6th, there was BP discovered the leak at Flow Station 2 in the oil transit line. They notified the authorities and they implemented the procedures to stop the leak and began the process of suspending production from the entire field. And the House of Representatives were informed about it just before they voted, and it passed the House 29-10. But as more information came out, the level of concern regarding the effect of the spill heightened. Legislators did not want the state of Alaska to end up paying for the results of a spill under the PPT if the standards had been ignored, exactly the kind of thing you're concerned about today. And as a result, the Senate Super Committee, because all the senators belong to it, almost, went over the whole lease expenditure piece again. And they added and re-added and talked about lease expenditures would not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. And there was a lot of discussion at the time about whether to go to negligence and gross negligence. And it was decided on much of the same information that Commissioner John Norman, the AOGCC, talked about the other day, to go with gross negligence. It was further decided that costs incurred for containment, control, cleanup, or removal in connection with any unpermitted release of oil or hazardous substance would not be included as lease expenditures. So incidents, bills related to an incident, cannot be deducted. The last thing they did was, they still had questions about how they were going to handle incidents from this bill. And so there was two amendments before the Senate Special Committee on Natural Gas Development, Amendment 9 and Amendment 13, which is the same language as the amendments you're looking at today in this bill, exactly the same language. And exactly the same issues came up again. What the heck does improperly maintained mean? There's no legal meaning. What does diminished capacity mean? Who decides in the first place? An auditor? What's going to be the red flag for the auditor? Does there have to be an incident like a spill? That's already taken care of under unpermitted releases. If no incident takes place, does that mean that every expenditure has to be audited? And so in response to this, Pedro Van Muers, who was the consultant, did two presentations to the Senate that talked about a way to do it. And on August 8th, he had a white paper saying disallowing deemed capital costs. And he said, should companies receive a tax deduction and tax credit together with 40% of the value, that was under the 2020, for replacing a pipeline that was defective and not properly maintained? And he said, well, and it brings up a larger policy area, the gray area between betterment and repair and replacement. And what he suggested is you do not want to do a case-by-case audit. You do not want to be auditing every single expenditure. You don't have the time. You don't have the personnel. It will cost you more than it's not done. And the other thing is it's not done anywhere. So he suggested that you disallow 30 cents per barrel for every barrel produced, regardless if there's any question. And that will take care of, and it adds about $45 million to $100 million a year in taxes. And that will take care of any kind of general maintenance that otherwise you'd have to do an audit of every expenditure for. And that was what the Senate agreed on to do, that instead of doing an audit on every single expenditure, they would take this 30 cents a barrel, regardless of if a company had an issue or not, and so to make sure to keep the state whole.
Judy, is the 30 cents you're talking about maintenance or capital improvements?
The 30 cents is the 30 cents is per barrel.
Correct.
It's a per barrel cost, and it makes up for any costs. I think Commissioner Norman talked about it in terms of that you always expect to have some breakdowns when you're talking about equipment or you're talking about this, but you expect it. And if you want to call it simple negligence, if you want to say that everything that ever happens is based on some kind of negligence or just simple equipment breakdown from age, then this covers that. So it covers it takes the place. You don't get to deduct. That's not the way to say it. You pay the 30 cents regardless of whether you have an issue or not. And so the state doesn't have to do a audit for each expenditure because most stuff's taken care of. It's only when you have what you're not going to be able to deduct. You can't deduct bill. You can't deduct anything that one of your partners questions or disallows. You can't deduct things that are not usual operating expenses. So under that scenario, the state was protected from the things that operators protect each other from and that most jurisdictions protect themselves from. And in addition, for any miscellaneous maintenance or capital costs, you had the 30 cents, which adds, again, depending on production, 30 cents a barrel for whatever your production is that year.
Okay, Judy, use the word capital cost just then. I'm guessing that we have it's a net profits tax, and that is take all your costs and subtract them from your gross profit.
Right.
You reach a net profit. I thought from hearing someone else in the oil industry, the 30 cents covered capital expenses, not maintenance expenses.
Well, I'll tell you how they say it in the Department of Revenue source book for the fall of 2006. In order to protect the state from crediting companies for unmet maintenance obligations, the legislature specifically disallowed capital expenditures up to 30 cents per barrel under the PPT. So that's how the Department of Revenue explains it.
And they use the word capital expenditures.
They use it. Here's how they say it again. In order to protect the state from crediting companies for unmet maintenance obligations, the legislature specifically disallowed capital expenditures up to 30 cents per barrel under the PPT.
Okay, so unmet maintenance leading to a capital expenditure is where the 30 cents is used.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just, that's my understanding.
Okay, that's mine too, that if indeed there's no capital expenditure, then you don't get this 30 cents for maintenance.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's, okay. You pay the 30 cents regardless.
We're accepting, actually, I don't know that we actually get 30 cents. We kind of, you submit bills and deduct 30 cents a barrel from the bills, and the net is, I'm going to leave this situation right here, because I'm going to have someone in the audience that is nodding his head and is going to be able to come up and say, let me explain it as clearly as I know. So, Judy, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm terribly grateful for that. All right. So the when Commissioner Norman, who made it from the AOGCC, made it, and who made it very clear that he would carry out any mandate the legislature passed, talked about how negligence is looked at, and he talked about it being intentional or willful, and then gross negligence, simple negligence, and strict liability. And he pointed out that the PPT as it stands now protects the state against intentional or willful negligence, gross negligence, and strict liability. And the strict liability protection comes in the part where it says any unpermitted release. It doesn't make any difference what the reason was. You can't deduct that. And he said, so that only leaves simple negligence. And that's where he made the point that simple negligence is where things happen. They just happen, especially when you have a lot of equipment along, and that most jurisdictions and no working agreement has that as a reason for not paying. And if you were going to go into that level, you were talking about trying to bulletproof or zero tolerance for almost any capital expense. In other words, the bill would almost, he did not say this, he did not reach the same conclusion that I have, that the bill no longer functions as a vehicle for sharing the risk. So I think the thing that the now the sponsors may want to do, and the legislator may want to, and the rest of the legislators may want to do, is review the protections that you already have and be clear about whether you think you're protected enough. And some of the conversation today among the legislators, at some point you begin to go down a rabbit hole where you're trying to decide, as you said, what kind of oil, what heavy oil or light oil, what do you do for this field opposed to this field, and you become in effect oil field operators yourselves, or the state does, which for the purposes of this bill is going to add, the cost will be probably more than we make from the taxes. And then look at, if you do decide to go forward, if you decide you're protected enough, then the exercise of going through all of this reasoning and thinking yet again, I think, has been very helpful. I think everybody's learned more about the PPT. We're learning more about the PPT, and I think people are beginning in general to feel more comfortable. They are, in fact, protected. If you still think you're not protected, then please concentrate on standards that have legal meaning, that don't allow auditors to just go on and on. And that give them no direction, and give the commissioners no direction, and give the courts no direction, and especially give the producers no direction. Limit the application. Right now, there's no beginning. It's not incident-driven anymore, the way you're moving. It just has to be any expenditure that, what, somebody said catches the auditor's eye? Has to go through this amazing exercise, then, and it has no end, because you've added the cascading you know, if this was affected by this, if this affected this, then if you continue to be unable to deduct it, and that's the A, B, and C piece. So I'm hoping that you will either decide that you're comfortable that you're as covered as you can be, that there is no bulletproof, you cannot bulletproof this. You've already said what you're mainly concerned about. You've covered the things that anybody would be expected to cover and that people who deal with this every day do cover. And then if you do change it in a way that we can live with it and not go into a permanent adversarial position between the state and the oil industry. And I do believe that part of the answer, I hope, will come from this new Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. Thank you very much.
Judy, let me ask you a question. You have children?
Yes, sir.
And when there's an incident, you reprimand them and you go, listen, you can't do this. And their response is, well, will you mind putting in writing all of those things so that I can avoid having an incident again? And you'll probably find that for you to say, you know what a good kid is? And then the kid will say, go ahead, tell me. And you'll go, oh, dear. And I think that's exactly when you mentioned, don't let this thing be incident-driven. I think that's pretty much the message.
No, I'm sorry. What I meant was, right now it is not incident-driven, so it's wide open. And so, you know, what you were concerned about was an incident, and you've got protection for that in here. Right now, there's no action that actually starts an audit, so that means everything's going to have to be audited. Because everything then has to be audited for improper maintenance, I guess. Because it's not there's nothing to start it. There's no flag that says, okay, auditor, this is something that should go up. So everything that's new, I guess, or every capital expenditure becomes open to audit.
So you're saying let the oil flow. When there's an incident that occurs, we'll know it.
Yes, and you're protected already when an incident occurs. You already have that language in there.
Judy, is most of what you've said written down somewhere?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm going because we thought there was going to be a CS today, and I was trying to focus on the policy issue. Some of this is in our testimony, and I will type up the rest. I have the notes here. I have the typing here. I'll type up the rest of it and send it to you.
That would be very helpful, and I would appreciate it. Does that conclude your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
And Michael Hurley is here. Michael, can you mind going front and center there?
I'll teach you to stand.
We've been talking about you.
Michael is going to help us with the 30 cents. And you might want to just hang on the line there and see what the 30 cents means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I need Michael, name and ID.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Michael Hurley. I'm the Director of State Government Relations for ConocoPhillips in Anchorage. You had a question about the 30 cents. And if I might direct the committee's attention to a memo that's in your packets from Pedro Van Meer's, dated, I think it's August the 8th. Mr. Chairman, a lot of this was discussed at the time. You know, at the time PPT was being developed and different provisions were being put together about what was going to be included and excluded in terms of costs. The incident that happened at Prudhoe Bay was right in the middle of that. There was a lot of discussion. There was, as a body, the legislature has the ability and the obligation to decide what things are in and what things are out. What things can be deducted, and what things they really didn't want to pay for. And that's appropriate. The issue then became, do you want to try and do it on an incident-by-incident basis with all the attendant audits and fights and everything else, or do you want to try and develop some kind of a proxy? Do you want to just develop some kind of a standard deduction to the deductions for maintenance that we know you're going to screw up? And that choice was debated. And the choice that was made was, okay, based on Pedro's memo and his analysis, the choice was made, we're just going to take 30 cents a barrel and disallow that deduction. And really, it doesn't matter if it's capital expense. I mean, if you look at the way the PPT works, if you're talking about, you know, revenue minus cash flow out the door, it doesn't matter if it's capital or expense or anything else. It's 30 cents a barrel, period, to handle this kind of stuff. That was what Pedro recommended and explained in this memo. And he explicitly says in the very last paragraph on the second page, and if I might quote, Mr. Chairman, I believe that this would provide a good answer to possible public criticism that under PPT, we would provide 50% of the replacement cost of pipelines as a result of the Prudhoe Bay shutdown. That's, Mr. Chairman, that's what this is all about. And we believe House Bill 128 is, in essence, duplicative, because that policy call, which is an appropriate policy choice to make, has been made. It was made to go with the 30 cents to cover that. Now, you may want to revisit that policy call, and you may want to say, well, we've decided we want to go incident by incident instead. But we believe it's very inappropriate to do both. We don't think it's fair to have the 30 cents, which is what this was all about, and an incident by incident disallowance as proposed in House Bill 128. Mr. Chairman, does that explain the 30 cents?
So the 30, we don't really care what the 30 cents is used for. Maintenance, replacement, that's all you get.
Right.
Now,
well, that's all we don't get.
I'm sorry. You only get the 30 cents to pay for maintenance or replacement. That's all you get as a deduction.
No, Mr. Chairman, the way it works is we have a bucket of costs that we will be allowed to deduct against our revenue. But from that bucket of costs, we have to take some out. And the amount we have to take out and that we can no longer deduct is 30 cents a barrel. So it's that 30 cents is an amount that we would have been able to deduct, but now we no longer can.
That's where I started, and I've had more explanations on this 30 cents than I've kind of gone back to the beginning. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did some figuring here, and say we're down to 750,000 barrels a day. And using that at 30%, that's $81 million a year. I mean, I'm guessing. And so you're saying that you can deduct the $81 million, but you can't deduct anything else?
No, Representative Wilson, through the chair. The numbers that Pedro had used in his analysis ended up being like 40. It's somewhere in the $40 to $50 million range.
Well, he was basing it on 800,000 barrels
right,
a day.
Right. But what happens is when we, the maintenance costs that we incur to run the fields, guessing is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm going to pick a number and I'm going to say it's $345 million that we would deduct against all of our revenue for maintenance. But because of that provision, instead of deducting the full 345, we can now only deduct 305 because we had to pull out
30 cents.
So instead of deducting all of our costs, we get to deduct fewer number of costs.
I understand.
Representative Seaton?
Oh, because of the 20% tax credit and the 20%.
This is prior to other things. When you talk about the deductions and.
Yes.
It's the first thing that happens.
Okay. Yes, Mr.
Chairman. And what we're saying here is if an incident happened, it's already covered.
If
in the 30 cents. And if it's more than 30, and if you.
And Mr. Chairman, it's actually covered actually a couple of other different ways, which we were going to get into in our testimony, in that if. It's already meant to be covered by that 30 cents. Additionally, as Representative Seaton pointed out the other day, if it's something that is not allowed as good oil field practice within the unit between the owners, if an operator does something that the other owners won't pay for, then the state doesn't have to pay for it either. So
you can get that kind of cooperation between three oil companies?
Mr. Chairman, there are lots of times when we don't cooperate.
Is it most of the time or some of the time?
Mr. Chairman, we always try and play well with others whenever we can.
That means no answer. All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've just promoted you to chairman of the board of your company. Would you contest this expenditure on this particular incident? And you, I understand.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, at this time, we've had discussions with the operator, Prudhoe Bay, about their plans to fix transit lines, replace transit lines, do what they're going to do. They have made proposals to the other owners to fund some of those activities. Those are currently under review. They have not yet been approved.
What did he say? Now, that was a very good answer. But, Mr. Chairman, and I understand that the transit lines, but we're really dealing with an incident here. And if you just want to say you don't answer, I won't go for it. But this particular incident that's going to be $100 million or whatever number, X number million dollars to repair, you and the three producers can get together and say, we don't want to allow that. Or you do. Is that correct?
And through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes. At some point, we will sit down and finish a review of that. But at this point, we've only had one AFE submitted to the other owners from the operator. And there have been some technical discussions, but those have not, by any stretch, this is actually going to be a very long process to do all the things that they have talked about doing in their program. And the discussions with the other owners about the technical feasibility, the cost and schedule of it, whether there's other ways to do it, all those discussions really haven't been completed, and the analysis of the issues by the other owners have not yet been completed. I truly don't know the answer to that. There will be a decision made at some point.
Mr. Chairman, I think that goes back to, I'm wondering if we're not a little cart before the horse. We don't have regulations yet. I mean, we don't know, you know, in a year or whenever the regulations may come out and this would be totally covered, and I'm just kind of trying to get a handle on. We are talking about a process here as opposed to a, you know, looking down the road, and I'm a little uncomfortable looking that far. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure if this is for you or for Judy Brady. I mean, it was brought up, but if I'm going to go back and forth, I'd appreciate that. There was the idea of good oil field practices will be applied at each tax return, and then if not at every audit, is that, would that be something that you would contest as far as selective enforcement? In other words, what I'm trying to get is, no longer are we, with this provision that we're putting in here, it's not incident-driven, it just applies on an expenditure that might not have had or might have resulted from improper maintenance. So I'm trying to get your perspective on what you would expect as far as the tax auditing on that, because it's not a spill response, it's a tax audit function. So if every time you submit your taxes, they aren't looked at in this way, and it's only when they decide to pick on a certain situation, is that kind of a selective enforcement something that would rise to the level of litigation for you guys?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that is one of the issues that concerns us about how this particular disallowance structure is set up, because it would be incident-driven. In essence, the first cut at it, if you will, would be when we file our monthly production tax return and an auditor sits down and looks at it, he's going to make some decision with some level of expertise, which I would not expect to be much, on good oil field practices. And then he's going to say, well, I think this looks a little sketchy. And then he's going to go either to DNR or the AOGCC and try and get them to agree that, well, maybe they shouldn't have done it that way. It concerns us a little bit, because the standard that would be put out here would be what they would be judging on, and you're asking an auditor who's basically reviewing a tax return from an audit perspective whether or not something passes that first test of, was that an expenditure made in poor oil field practice? Or what's the right word now? Poor.
Good.
Yes. Right. I mean, however that, you're asking an auditor to do that first cut, and that's a little disconcerting to us.
And I guess just a follow-up.
Go ahead.
And I guess the question that I'm trying to get at is this really incident-driven or is it investment-driven? I mean, it seems like it's really investment-driven because it's a tax audit. It's not an incident that occurred. It's an investment. And then if there is a large expenditure, then that's going to be looked at to see if there was any way that improper maintenance could have caused that large expenditure. But it has nothing to do with the incident. Am I mistaken? And maybe I'm misreading.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that's probably correct. I mean, if you're an auditor and your job is to maximize dollars to the state, you're going to look for things that you can say, oh, that might have been improper maintenance. I mean, if that's your job, that's what you would do. And it will be driven by their review of tax audits rather than necessarily by any incident that actually occurred or didn't occur.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess we have somebody from Revenue here that can address it later for us.
Okay. Any other questions? John Iverson, are you on the phone?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is John.
John, please introduce yourself and your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
This is John Iverson. I'm the Director of Tax for the Department of Revenue. In terms of these sort of costs being picked up, I would envision, and I've had some discussions with Gary Rogers, who's the audit supervisor for the oil and gas revenue section, which would be the section implementing this. And there are a number of different ways that we've kind of looked at how these costs would turn up. One of the ways would be just, you know, it's front page news, like this one. If that's a case that happens, then we would be on the lookout for that. If those costs are sought as part of a deduction or as part of a credit, then we would be conferring with the Department of Natural Resources and the AOGCC as appropriate to make that determination one way or the other. Another way would be that we don't hear about it, but there's an application for a credit for that. So that would be another way that would turn up. If there's for a recovery for a credit for that expenditure to replace or repair whatever went wrong. And then another way would be on audit. And then on the audit side of things, essentially what you'd be seeing is a big number that's uncharacteristic of things, or just an odd sort of thing that would inspire an auditor to ask some questions as part of the audit, and then they'd hone in on it from there. And then again, when we start asking questions, if the auditor turns up something that seems like it would fall under improper maintenance, then again, we would be conferring with the Department of Natural Resources or the AOGCC or the DEC as appropriate. And I hope that's helpful. If there's some follow-up questions, I'd certainly be able to field them or find someone who would.
Thanks. Representative Johnson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you envision auditing every return?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, that is a good question. So let me grab Gary Rogers real fast, and because he's sitting right next door to me, and we'll get an answer for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Well, let's just take a couple of minutes off here. So we'll go off the record here until... And John, go ahead.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, Gary, the question has been raised as to whether we would be auditing every return for these sort of costs that are the subject of this bill.
I think if you knew where the costs basically were coming from and the unit operator and the partners, you would at least audit the returns of those partners involved. So, in essence, yes.
Is that essentially what your job is, to audit every return?
Pretty much. Sometimes the audits are full-blown field audits, and sometimes it may be just a desk audit. We use audit judgment, professional judgment. Materiality comes into play.
It reminds me of sampling, and I think that's probably things the IRS does to determine who to audit. That there are certain red flags, oil spills, and there are certain times when you might want to pick the 3rd, 8th, and 15th line to audit. Is that a way that you do it?
We're in the process of developing the audit program for this new tax. The way we have done it in the past is we only have 14 or 15 taxpayers. We are able to look at every taxpayer's return. But now with the complexity and the volume of information and the increase in the number of expenditures and deductions, we may not have that luxury. So we may have to choose which ones we audit and which ones we don't. We're in the process of developing that program. We don't have that program in place yet.
Or hire more people?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Johnson has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'd mentioned I think you called it a full-blown field audit as opposed to a desk audit. Would you explain to me what a full-blown field audit is as opposed to a desk audit? Do you actually go out to the field and look and see if this stuff is done, or what do you do?
I apologize for using probably slang of the profession. In a field audit, we would actually go to the taxpayers' offices, review records and documentation that they have in their offices. As a desk audit, you might just look at the return they filed and decide whether you need more information, such as source documents, original invoices, original contracts. A standard audit procedure, though, is to actually go in the field and observe the facilities, the assets, the equipment. Is it really, does it really exist? Is it really in place?
Mr. Chair.
I've done that before in my job here. We don't do it very often, but it's a normal standard audit practice.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are any of your auditors chemical engineers or oil field engineers, or are you just, and I don't mean to say just accountants because it's a very important profession, but are you accountants, or is there special training that allows you to go and say that is or isn't good oil field practice?
We are not chemical engineers or petroleum engineers or engineers of any type. We would consult with engineers if we felt there was an issue that we needed an engineer's opinion on. We do study oil and gas industry accounting practices, oil and gas industry joint venture auditing practices, oil and gas industry financial reporting practices. So we're basically accountants and auditors by trade, but we have a specialized industry here, oil and gas, and so we have to learn that industry too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where do the when you do need to consult with an engineer, where do they live? Is that a DNR position, or do you use outside engineers, or where do you go for your expertise?
We currently have an engineer on contract that assists us with property tax. We use him. We use the engineers at DNR. We talked to the people over at Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I would anticipate needing, you know, outside contract experts.
I'm sorry, did you say you anticipate needing outside expert contracts to do these audits?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. John Norman, are you online? John Norman. Okay. Well, John Norman was Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Kevin Banks, are you online? They are not appear to be on.
I am, Mr. Chairman. I'm online. And we were just unmuted, so I'm not sure if John Norman was able to respond when you asked him.
Okay. That sounds like Kevin I'm talking to.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Let me just back up. John Norman, are you online? Okay, absent John's testimony, Kevin, is there some testimony? And I have a couple questions for you, but go ahead if you have something you wanted to present, or you're just here for questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just here for questions today.
Okay, I got one for you. Just dealing with the words gross negligence, and I'm going to Black's Law Dictionary. It's an important guy. And he defines gross negligence as requiring willful, wanton, or reckless misconduct. And here's the key, or such utter lack of all care as will be evidence thereof. Does that mean if something happened, that really is the definition of gross negligence?
Are you saying, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I don't quite understand the question, I guess. Maybe could you please rephrase it?
What I'm saying is it looks like Black's Law Dictionary says, and the last part of the definition, as will be evidence thereof. So if indeed we have some evidence, does it immediately default to gross negligence, even if it isn't willful, wanton, or reckless, or utterly lack of care? Or does it simply say, listen, if something happened, that's gross negligence?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that I'm out of my depth here.
Okay.
You're asking me to interpret a legal phrase, and I don't think it would be fair to the committee if I started thinking about what you've just read to me and providing you with my poor knowledge about it.
It probably seems like a trap. It wasn't intended to be that. We are really still dealing with the basics, and that is to define negligence, gross negligence, improper maintenance, willful disregard, and to somehow come up with good oil field practices. and morph them into good oil field practices, which now is probably going to use the same terms all over again.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what the evidence thereof strikes me is that you'd want to find out if the accident was caused by someone performing with utter disregard. So you're looking for, you know, what did someone do or fail to do in that situation? And that negligence or good oil field practices or the lack of good oil field practices is something that's broader in scope and doesn't require that someone has done something with the intent or willful intent to cause an accident or cause some incident, I should say.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody ever used the word willful because that's such a high bar to say, you know what, why don't we just willfully disregard proper maintenance? Although it's possible if you say the advantage is that when the pipe breaks, we get to expense it in a different way, and that really saves us money. And even though it might sound preposterous, I mean, you always want to look, if you're curious, in that direction for a possibility. However, we have not really gone to that level here. Is there anything else? That's the last person I have here that wanted to testify, except for John Norman, in case he's back online. And apparently not. Representative Wilson has a question for you.
If I understand it right, soon, by the end of this month, we will have the first, I don't know what you call it, tax return. Then we will have some real figures to deal with, and right now everything is so hypothetical that it's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. Can't we just wait and you know, this, if it's, well, first of all, is that true? Is it by the end of this month we'll have something concrete?
Mr. Chairman, is that directed to me or John Iverson, please?
Whoever can answer it.
Mr. Chairman, this is John Iverson.
John, did you understand the question, or would you like it repeated?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, just fine.
Thank you. Yes, I did. I did understand the question. Through the chair, it is correct that we are going to be getting returns in at the end of this month. It's actually, since the 31st falls on a weekend, it's going to be the first business day after, and we will know more at that point in terms of the gross numbers that are coming in. We won't really know as far as what's actually being claimed until we go through an analysis of the returns. We get applications for credits. We get, you know, have it go through the audit cycle. And that's going to be quite some time. We have a 3-year audit cycle. There's going to be some time there for also for amended returns. Another aspect to consider is that although we could release, we can release the gross numbers in terms of the gross receipts and everything that was paid in total, we can't release any information about any given taxpayer because it's confidential under statute.
True.
Mr. Chairman.
Good point. Representative Johnson has a question.
Yeah. Could they waive that confidentiality?
Through the chair, the answer to that is yes, that this is the taxpayer's confidentiality. It belongs to them. We protect it, but they could execute a waiver of confidentiality.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Norman. I apologize. Somehow in the muting, I apparently wasn't transmitting through, so I want to let you know I am on the line, and I would be happy to, if I could, answer any questions.
Okay, John, thanks for the apology. Did you have comments or just available for questions?
Just a few comments because, Mr. Chairman, I've already said quite a bit the last time. I would point out in listening to the discussion There is a reference in Alaska statute to good oil field engineering practice, and that is found at
AS 31.15.010.
And that's found in the definition of waste. That's where we normally apply it. And we've worked with that concept of failure to apply good practice, because if a pipeline should rupture, gas escapes, or something else, we ask ourselves, was this an act of God? Was there an earthquake? Or was there a failure to apply good oil field practice? So it's not a new concept, and it does also exist in several different places in our regulations, again, primarily focused on determination of waste. But it is a term that is known and used within the industry, not frequently, but at least it's something that's there, and it generally would tie back into API standards and other professional standards, ASME and other professional organizations.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. John, since you'd be one of the guys that would be working on making the decision on this, I guess, or at least you're in one of those agencies, you know, we had testimony that this would be raised by something seen in the newspaper, an application for credit for expenditures to replace or repair something large, or from an audit, a big number or something odd, that those would kick it up to you, I propose, or I mean, I suppose, to make the determination with the other commissioners. And I'm just trying to figure out, when you see the legal language that says, okay, you're going to make this determination and you're going to take into consideration good oil field practices, does your understanding of take into consideration mean that those are the black and white standards that you are going to use, or does that mean that those are things that in the normal parlance of take into consideration, meaning you look at them but don't necessarily follow them as a strict guideline?
Yes, through the chair, thank you, Representative, for the question, and I do understand the question. We would apply the black letter standards to the extent they exist, and the point we've made in prior correspondence is in many instances they don't exist, but to the extent they existed, that would absolutely be a starting point. But then we would apply it, I hope, with a measure of common sense in taking into consideration the totality of the circumstances. But that would be a starting point if we did have definite written standards in existence.
Okay.
Can I follow up?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Representative Seaton, follow up.
And so I'm trying to understand how this would be applied. I mean, the auditor is going to be there, and we've heard how that they would identify these things, you know, the newspaper, the application of credit or an audit, and then it would get kicked to you. How do you go about making the determination where there was improper maintenance?
If it were kicked to us, and I would expect it, the newspaper would be something that would identify an incident, but normally there would be a time lag between the filing of a taxpayer's return and the claiming of a lease expenditure, and working through the different filters, as we mentioned. Was it a result of fraudulent willful? Was it a result of gross negligence? Is it something else that's covered? But when it worked down to us, the time would be a concern, because there is a need in oil field diagnostic looking for root causes, the diagnostic analysis, to jump on it fairly quickly, get that pipe, get a piece of it, do some analysis, and we and so that's on my mind. I have to identify that as a concern that we would have, because if we're called in the course of a normal tax audit some years later, the information gets stale, if you will. It may dissipate. The urgency of the situation may dictate an immediate repair, and there isn't time to contemplate whether it is deductible or not, and then we're called in later. So the earlier we would get involved, I think the more accurate our assessment would be. Generally speaking, on the things we look at now, there are reporting requirements to the AOGCC. They come in daily, constantly, I would say that, and we're aware of it. We have inspectors on the slope. We'd look at it, but as far as matching it up with a tax deduction, that is going to be somewhat awkward, and we would do our best, as I've repeatedly said, to try to work out some protocol with revenue, but we'd want some retention of evidence so that we would have the ability to go in and look at it and make a determination concerning application of good oil field practices. I hope, Representative Seaton, through the chair, that answers your question, and if not, please let me know.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does on some of it, like with, and I think that clarifies with the newspaper, but if we, an incident, but mainly what we've been talking about here is not the incident driven, but just the application for credit for expenditures to replace or repair. And my understanding, maybe you can give me some other feedback on here, but that's after the expenditure is made. And then the application for the credit comes in with the tax payment. So that would be after that repair or replacement had already occurred. And so is what you're saying is that we would have to establish a new procedure almost, that the replaced or repaired items would have to be kept in place until, especially high value ones, so that you could determine if that was replaced or repaired because of improper maintenance?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, here would be my answer to that. Generally speaking, in instances where there would be gross negligence, willful misconduct, careless disregard, they often self-identify themselves. They leap out at you, and so those are the ones that are going to be the most obvious. We would probably have received advance notice. We might have been on the scene anyway. We would have developed our own investigative file, and so if a contact came in from revenue, that would be the type of thing that we would say, yes, we have an incident file, we have an investigative file, we've been looking at it. The more difficult situations are going to be a breakdown of a piece of equipment, a blown gasket, a replacement of a compressor that may go on in the ordinary course of business, and in fact do go on every day in the ordinary course of not just the oil industry, but any industry. Those are more problematic because it's not the type of thing that we open incident files on. It's a frequent occurrence in any industry that equipment is replaced, things are done, and we monitor. There, we're more incident or event oriented to respond. And we look for incidents of failure to file good oil field practice for purposes of coming in and telling an operator that this incident happened. We're making a formal determination of waste, which causes them to bear an added penalty. But insofar as being able to monitor these, that's why I do feel compelled to point out that we're moving into somewhat of a new area in looking at negligence, because that's what I consider this to be. The failure to follow a standard, said differently, is neglecting to follow that standard. You can neglect to do something, and that's negligence or ordinary negligence. If you are or should be more mindful of it, then it's neglecting it with careless disregard of the consequences, or perhaps a degree of recklessness. But that's not what this is going to identify by definition, because that's already addressed in the statute. So we're seeking to pick up a whole other level of conduct that we previously have not monitored, which is just ordinary maintenance. Now, if it violated some of our specific regulations, again, we would be aware of it. Our inspectors are out all the time. They're checking safety valve systems, blowout prevention equipment, monitoring pressures in pipes within the area that we work. So we would know that. But there are other areas of maintenance that I would see could become problematic, because we might not have a question presented to us until, in the ordinary course of filing a return and giving an auditor the time they need to look through it, raising a question, it may come along well after an event, and it may be hard to pin it down and date stamp just because the event is stale by that time.
John, just to summarize here, the question of gross negligence, fraud, willful misconduct is already in the PPT. And that this bill really only addresses the simple concept of improper maintenance, but not rising to the level of gross maintenance. I'm sorry, gross negligence, not gross maintenance. So we're only dealing with the word improper. And I guess is everything we're doing being driven simply trying to identify what improper is?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe so. And it can be done, but we're dealing with much more subtle distinctions. Generally, you start out with an analysis in the concept of what I would call simple negligence, and there's the concept of was this foreseeable? Did it cause the particular event? But I keep returning to the word negligence, because if between subsection 6 and 19 we're intending even a broader standard than negligence, then I think we're even moving towards strict liability, which is almost saying you must guarantee a perfect operation. And that, I don't need to tell any of us, is an impossibility in this human world we live in.
Well, my mother always expected it.
And mine too, sir.
And Mr. Norman, I'm going to cut you off now, and thank you very much for your comments, because we have very few minutes left, and I wanted to get to Jason Brune, who is actually here in the audience from the Resource Development Council, and I wanted to give him an opportunity so he doesn't have to come back in bad weather or something like that. So, yeah, Jason, welcome to the Resources Committee. Please identify yourself, your affiliation, and then go ahead and tell us what you know.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I am the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. RDC is a statewide business association. We have a very diverse membership. Our members include companies such as oil and gas companies, mining, timber, fisheries, tourism. Hi. We also have all of the regional native corporations as members, local communities, labor. So it's a very, very diverse membership. And so on behalf of that diverse membership that I'll give my comments today in opposition to HB 128. despite the political pressure that's there to pass this legislation, and in light of the 21 co-sponsors on of this bill, HB 128 is still bad legislation. It's bad public policy, and it's potentially precedent-setting for other industries in the state. With the passing of the PPT legislation last year, the state effectively tripled the production taxes on the oil industry in Alaska. In fact, this likely will result in over $1 billion in additional revenue to the state this fiscal year. In exchange for these additional taxes, producers are now allowed to deduct operating expenses when calculating these taxes. In addition, they're also allowed to take a 20% tax credit for capital investments as an incentive for improving the North Slope infrastructure. These deductions may not include, as Commissioner Norman indicated, costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. I, too, like you, took the time to look up gross negligence in a law dictionary, and the definition I got was, quote, a careless disregard for the consequences of an action or lack of action. And I think that's important. Lack of action is part of that definition as well. This bill proposes to disallow costs, quote, related to the repair and replacement of property or equipment that was not maintained or was improperly maintained. By my read, it's already covered under the current gross negligent requirement. If, however, this language is adopted, it must be asked, how do you define improper maintenance? HB 128 doesn't define it. In fact, in a letter from AOGCC Commissioner Norman of February 16th, he echoed these sentiments. And I'm going to just quote him one sentence from it. Quote, our main concern with this bill is the absence of a precise definition of improper maintenance. The bill proposes relying on standard practices of the industry to gauge whether there has been improper maintenance, but often there are not established industry standards to rely upon, end quote. This then brings up the question, what would it take for the state to declare improper maintenance? Would it take a spill? As an example, let's say you have two sets of pipe that have the same maintenance history. One develops a leak, one doesn't. When replacing both sets of the pipe, would one be allowable as an expense and the other not? Would this legislation cause the producers to overcorrect and replace pipe much more frequently than necessary so they can make sure they qualify for the deduction? At the end of the day, by doing this, it nets back less for Alaska, as these expenses would then be permissible. Our members feel this legislation will exponentially increase disputes between the state and the producers. I guarantee passage of this legislation will ultimately lead to endless litigation. In conclusion, I'll reiterate RDC opposes this legislation and feels the gross negligence standard is in place to satisfy the intent of this bill. I encourage you to give last year's PPT legislation a chance to work before changing it. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
I love your word, I guarantee. Because if indeed you're guaranteeing it, RDC then would have to what? Pay us something? I don't know. I like your term, though. It means you're very strongly convinced.
Yes.
But not guaranteeing.
Mr. Chairman, I think the history has proven that
it will inevitably do that. That's correct. Why lawyers make a living. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And oil companies, they have lawyers?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman. Just asking a question
here. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate, Jason, you coming here for this. You're leaving town and not be back on Monday?
Correct. But I will be calling in.
You will be. Okay,
yes,
I appreciate that very much. Are there any further questions? Because we do have another committee meeting at 3, and it is barely a couple of minutes away. Representative Wilson, last question. Go ahead.
It's just a comment. Because there's so many unanswerable questions to this bill, I've asked to have my name removed from the...
Sponsors?
Yes.
Surely. So, we now have 20 sponsors. And who knows how many more will, if they've been listening to the testimony, will say, I'm not as sure as I was earlier. We don't know. Maybe 10 more will pile on. I don't know. But at this point, for the record, Representative Wilson has stated that she intends to remove her name as a sponsor. And that still leaves a couple more people on the committee that are still sponsors. So we do have plenty of pros on the bill. And with that, and hearing and seeing no more hands raised, this meeting is adjourned till Monday morning. I'm sorry, Monday at 1:00.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.